Welcome to Closeted History, the podcast where we out the queer and trans history that you never knew. I am Destiny, and I am joined by three of my comrades from the Intervention Pod. So do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, thanks for having us, Destiny. My name's Nick. I'm the co-host of the Intervention Podcast. We're focused on anti-imperialism. Steve and I got started with the podcast to focus on U.S. and U.K. imperialism. You'll know in a second why that is when you hear Steve talk. Levi joined us later on, and we brought in a focus on Zionism within that context as well, and understanding Zionism. But we'll probably touch on that later tonight. I don't want to say too much more. I mean, look, we appreciate you having us. I'm a straight white dude here. I'm a communist. I organize in real life. I'm here as like an ally in the LGBTQ plus struggle as part of the broader struggle against imperialism. So thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm Steve. Despite what Nick said, I think I've lost my accent. So I am originally from England. Yeah, and just echo exactly what Nick says. I'm a straight white guy as well, but here as an ally. So thank you very much for having us.
Cool. And do you want to share your pronouns as well?
Sorry. Yeah, he, him.
Yeah, same for me.
Yep. And I'm Levi, he, him. And as you might be able to tell from my talking, I'm Jewish, as my accent delivers. But yeah, echoing what my two esteemed co-hosts have said, straight white guy, ally, anti-imperialist.
Right on. I love it. So tonight we are joined in this little group because, as Nick mentioned, our struggles definitely intersect with one another. And so we just kind of wanted to take this opportunity to talk about how intersectionality impacts like the work that we're doing and in the fight for oppression. And I took a couple of questions because in particular, we really want to focus on what's going on in Palestine right now and some of the pink washing that we're seeing from a lot of the accounts and how that relates to the LGBTQ plus movement and the struggle. So that's just kind of where we're coming from and the end goal for this episode. So from the very beginning, like the queer liberation movement, it's very, very socialist. And I think, and we were talking in the show before the show, that, you know, not a lot of people know about the socialist roots of the LGBTQ plus movement. In your work, are there also misunderstandings about the LGBTQ plus movement, like from imperialists or?
I think like a general comment would be, as we go through all the history that we do and you try and, you know, counteract the propaganda that's out there, you know, and talking about pink washing as well, which I guess this ties in a little bit, but, you know, as things happen throughout time and, you know, it's usually radicals and comrades that start these struggles. But then at some point down the line, when something finally happens on a legal or a, you know, legislative background, it's always like the liberals who co-opt any movement. And we talk about that a lot, you know, and how to kind of counteract that and how to highlight the people that actually start these movements rather than just, oh, you know, I don't know, Obama was the one who did this. Well, you know, there's a lot more history that I think people, a general person that doesn't dig into it, won't know that stuff.
You know, I shared with y'all that really prior to October 7th, I feel like Palestine really wasn't like on my radar at all, even though I was a huge fan of Angela Davis and, you know, a lot of communists and leftists just in general who had spoken about the struggles of Palestinians. But you know, I didn't know anything about it until it was very public.
Yeah, I mean, one facet, I think, of the Palestinian struggle as it intersects with our struggle, and I think Angela Davis in particular has focused on this among many others, right? But it's like when we think about the police state, right? I think the history of the LGBTQ plus struggle is characterized by the radical LGBTQ plus struggle has been characterized by clashes with the police state, right? Like I know we wanted to talk about Stonewall a lot, but I think, you know, when we look at the US relationship to like the IDF or the better known as the occupation forces, the IOF, right? Like the relationship extends to such a level such that, like, we're all based in Pittsburgh. We're very open about that. But like Pittsburgh, among many other cities, actually sends police forces to be trained by the IOF mm-hmm. in like actual repression tactics that they use against the Palestinians, right? So when we talk about oppressed people fighting back, again, like the tactics are the same between these oppressive forces. So like, I mean, that's like a very specific instance and case to look at, you know, how these struggles are related against, like, you know, an oppressing mechanism within the hands of the power that be in that situation, you know. And that could extend to not just like tactics, like repressing uprisings and everything like that, but also just technology, which of course plays into the tactics, right? But like you're talking about transfers of surveillance technologies, identification, things that are used to enforce apartheid openly in Palestine, and what you could characterize as kind of like a hidden system of apartheid here with like the racial system, or however you want to kind of oppress groups within the borders of the U.S. as well.
I think that it's like our systemic ways that seem more implicit and in ways that you don't know about unless you're like really looking into, or it's, or something that you're experiencing. And, you know, as we mentioned a couple of times, that I'm in the room with three white dudes, but I'm also white, and you know, that does come with a lot of privilege, and that we don't experience the same systemic oppression that other folks do. But that's why it's important to talk about these things. And so I think that there are not only systemic ways that people are being oppressed, but also like overt ways with police brutality and like the carceral system. And, you know, it's definitely more than what we think about just in our daily interactions. And I think that that's also kind of how we get so disconnected from the history.
I think to struggle to sort of pull together a number of these threads that we've already mentioned, and to use the concept of intersectionality, that sort of $5 word that is so important in the way activism is understood today. But it's a word that we sort of take for granted that hasn't been around for very long. And I think it has to do with what Steve was saying earlier, that there are certain representations and peoples that have been mainstreamed, so that there's certain representations of queer identity that are considered appropriate, given time and place in the United States, that provide a certain amount of breathing room that allow people to think about their identity in a multi-layered, multi-level sense that is easy to take for granted in a place that we're at. And I think we might get to this on another episode, or maybe we'll get into this later, but that's where concepts like pinkwashing really come into play, because certain representations are acceptable, whereas more radical representations, the kind of people that we might pedestal or hold up in our collective history as radicals, as leftists, as communists, are not acceptable history or ways to represent our history. And I think that'll also come up in the way Stonewall has in some ways been appropriated as a sort of a postage stamp moment, in the same way that you can buy a Malcolm X Forever postage stamp. I believe this month they have one, but they don't want you to really look into what Malcolm X was saying.
Yeah. Luther King's like a great example. I mean, yeah, just another example of that, like whose radical politics have been whitewashed to the extent that like we can have a day, you know, like a national day as dictated by the same people that killed him. So like, I guess at like a very general level, like when Levi's talking about what's acceptable, I think when we're having these conversations, a question that we should all be asking ourselves is like, who is defining the terms of like acceptable image, acceptable participation, and what are their motivations in defining it that way, you know?
Yeah, because I think that it's not only about privilege, but also about positionality, and your proximity to things does also matter. And I love what you said, that like it does matter who is defining what those terms are. Because, you know, all of my favorite gays are communists also, but you know, that like a lot of that has been kind of desensitized and like not only whitewashed, but de-radicalized, I guess. And mentioned MLK, that a lot of times, like, Malcolm X is taught in juxtaposition to MLK. Nonviolence, you know, again, just appropriating his image and his words and, like, cherry picking what you want, because, like, MLK very openly socialist and critiqued capitalism, but we don't talk about those quotes. We just talk about the ones from the I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah. Or and that especially he was assassinated supporting the garbage workers union, that his class analysis was central to his ideology, especially by the end. That is absolutely never mentioned.
I think that people's unique relationships to money and to capitalism keeps them from understanding, like, that's what unifies our struggle. Obviously, there are other things that can unify us and we can celebrate our differences, but, you know, money is how they keep their thumb on us, you know, like the boot is crushing us because of capitalism. You know, we have to participate to eat and to live. And so I think that it can be really hard for people to think about those things, like when you're just doing what you can to survive and put food on the table for your kids.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, because we brought up the C word of class, you know, I think that we need to, like, be very explicit that, like, when we talk about terms like intersectionality, at least as I understand it, like, we have to understand that the intersection of these struggles is the class struggle, right? So, like, we're not just throwing out, like, an empty phrase when we say, like, these things are related, like, they're related on the basis of class. Now, again, it's not as simple. That we live in a very complicated world with, like, layers of stratification that have been imposed by systems of racism, systems of apartheid, systems of, you know, imperialism on a global scale. But, like, again, like, when we say that, like, we don't mean it as, like, we mean it very literally as, like, the meeting point of these struggles, the unifying point is class. And again, it's much harder to actually get together on that basis in real life as you're working through all of these other problems. But I think we do need to be explicit, like, what we mean when we say that, you know, at least as I understand that term.
Intersectionality, I can't remember who mentioned it, but that you said that it's kind of like relatively a new term, that it's been a term since like the 1980s. I think it was developed by Kimberly Crenshaw. She's a professor at UCLA, I believe. But, you know, she's been talking about it, but also I think that Black women and Black trans women face a different type of particular oppression. And I think that that is also apparent because when we're talking about all these queer femmes or Black women who are leading this work, that they're not getting the recognition that they deserve. You know, Black women in particular face a different kind of oppression in addition to, you know, oppression of class or documentation or any language barriers. And that's the really great thing about intersectionality, is that when you think about it from this framework, that there's, like, everyone has a different thing. Like, you know, when I look at it for myself in particular, that, as I mentioned, I'm a white woman, but also I have ADHD, I have fibromyalgia, so I would describe myself as disabled. But I was born in the United States, and so I'm a U.S. citizen. English was my first language, so there are still other ways that I have a lot of privileges. And I think when we recognize those things and we apply it to the work that we're doing, that, you know, we can all kind of come together. Because like you said, it is a point of coming together, but it's not the only one, you know. So, let's talk more about, like you mentioned, Stonewall. So, you know, Stonewall is actually, it's one of, like, my favorite events to talk about. I know that it is very, like, you can get a postage stamp, but I think that it's a really good starting place for someone just kind of getting into queer history, because it really introduces you to like the roots of things. You get introduced to Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, both who were there. They were both trans women of color who actually started an organization called STAR. They housed unhoused trans youth and, you know, helped to keep kids safe and give them community, and did a lot for the gay liberation movement. But years later, I think it was in 1972, when Sylvia was giving a speech, because Steve, you mentioned earlier about like when there's kind of a legal proceeding that gives us some progress within a movement, then couples were able to have like domestic partnerships and seeing progress in that regard in terms of like legality. And they totally left behind all of the trans people who helped them fight the police and house them and gave them food. And you look back and you look at archive footage of Marsha, and she just seems like the gentlest person. Everyone just has such nice things to say about her and about Sylvia. And they were both very openly anti-capitalist. And when Sylvia is giving that speech, she got booed off stage. And like, because there was kind of like a separation, actually. So after, let me back up some. So Stonewall was June 28th, 1969. It lasted 6 nights and police car was set on fire. Apparently Marsha jumped on top of that vehicle before it was on fire. Such a badass, right? She was there. She got there at like 2 or 3 a.m., but she wasn't the first person to throw the brick, heard around the world. There have been a lot of rumors about whether it was a brick or a shot glass or something else, but Stormy DeLarvery, a butch lesbian who was a drag king during that era, police have her hands behind her back, and he's like being all roughed up by the police. And so she yells out to the crowd, "Why don't you guys do something?" And it totally erupts, and police are trapped inside the bar. It's being set on fire. The police car is set on fire. And after Stonewall, it was kind of like, at least on the East Coast, queer community wasn't taking any shit anymore. Were ready to fight back and to stand up for who they are and who they wanted to be. And we start seeing some progress. But so after Stonewall, there's this organization called the Gay Liberation Front. And they're created, and they create Pride. And a bisexual woman, Brenda Howard, does a lot of the work in organizing for the Gay Liberation Front. But years later, there starts to be like some tensions. That speech happens in 1972 where Sylvia is booed off stage and people are telling her, you know, out of here, and they're forgetting all about the trans people who helped them. And then the Gay Liberation Front splits. So there are now two organizations, one who is like still keeping those very radical roots of like, okay, we're anti-capitalist, we just want human rights, we want housing, healthcare, you know, a lot of the things that we're advocating for today, because we still don't have them. And but then there was another group, and they just kept going with what they were doing. And that's where you see some of the rainbow capitalism starting. They start getting corporate sponsors. Then, you know, the police are now coming to the parades, and like, you're losing some of that history that is really, really crucial. So I think that while Stonewall is, you know, kind of overdone a little bit and very like poster child for the LGBTQ plus history canon, I think that it does serve as a really good starting place, because you get introduced to some really good key figures. And it's kind of like I describe it like a choose your own adventure. Like, okay, can we go into like the anti-capitalist roots, or like maybe you want to learn about drag kings, so you look into Stormy DeLarvery and lesbian history, or like performances and LGBTQ plus clubs. Like, Stonewall was a shithole. Like, you know, it was a mob run bar. And some of the movies that have come out would have you believe that it was like the finest establishment that, you know, could ever be bestowed upon the gays. And in the movie, actually in Stonewall, I think it came out in like 2018, some white dude throws a brick like in the movie. And so not only is it not included in the textbooks, but then we have shit movies that don't tell the story very accurately. And then a bunch of homophobes that keep the story from people anyway. So, yeah, definitely check out Stonewall. It's the best place to start because you can go forwards, you can go backwards, and a lot of the issues that are really centralized to those roots of like just wanting housing, you know, healthcare, basic rights to a human life, you know, as you are. Those conversations are still incredibly relevant today.
And to pull this into one of the pet projects or the acts that I like to grind, and the way we tell our history is actually incredibly political, because history itself is the creation of a narrative that justifies political actions or the existence of a people today. History is not dead. History is not even in the past. It continues to exist. So as you're saying, there's these movies, there's postage stamps. I believe it was made into a memorial by Barack Obama in 2016. There's specific factions that are trying to claim the Stonewall history in a specific narrative that suits their purposes. And that's what makes it, like you said, to paraphrase, something that is so incredibly obvious because everybody knows what we're referring to, at least on the most basic level, when we say Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
But no two people are necessarily going to have the same history in mind. Somebody that has only watched that Stonewall movie you mentioned is going to have a completely different set of assumptions as the person that listened to Barack Obama's speech when it was memorialized is going to have a completely different assumption to the individual you said was booed off stage for having a anti-capitalist stance. And I'll admit that I listened to your first few Closeted History episodes, and Stonewall is covered in that. And I liked in the very first episode you talked about, and correct my pronunciation here, Stormy
DeLarvier.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that they were represented as she, him, and he, or she, her, and he, him, depending on the sources, and that you were going to refer to them as he, him, because that was the most prominent, or that's how they represented themselves. And I think that gets to a core concept that I'm getting at, that people are going to affix something as simple as gender identity on individuals in that story that they're trying to tell because of larger political structures. And to even put it in the most positive sense, you know, there is an argument that there's some progress that's made when the police are attending these parades, but is that the direction we really want to see the movement in the long run, right? Because it's good. It's definitely a positive that we're capable of expressing ourselves on the streets. But what are the confines of that expression when the police are sanctioned at those events?
Well, in progress for who?
Exactly.
Yeah. And you were saying about Stormy that, like, honestly, that's probably one of the most difficult parts of having this podcast is that, like, how do you know? I mean, you know, all we have to go off of is like some interviews, oral history, and that like people's homophobia also impacts the recollection of queer history, that, you know, because they didn't care about what happened at Stonewall, it wasn't heavily reported on at the time. So, you know, when we have these historical events to look to, it can sort of be difficult to figure out what the truth is, because, you know, I I don't know. And like some websites did say he, him, and that's what Stormy was comfortable with. But then like one time I posted on TikTok about like Stormy being gender nonconforming, and people were very upset that I was like erasing lesbian history. And I was like, dude, I'm just sharing what I found. Here's the website. You can check it out too. It can be really difficult to know what's true.
If you don't mind, I'm sorry. I wanted to make another point real quick on Stonewall. But like, I think there's a lot there. And to the point that you guys are talking about in terms of actually interpreting history, right? And actually taking this and utilizing it as a tool, because I think we have to understand it if it can be, it is politically motivated. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, you know?
Right.
But like, from my perspective as like a communist organizer trying to look at the history, right, to fight against imperialism, to fight against the system, you know, I think we could look at a really positive outcome of Stonewall as being kind of like, again, the springboard of these revolutionary elements of that movement to connect with other revolutionary struggles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think at that point you could say, look, I think after Stonewall, again, from the people from the Gay Liberation Front started to get involved with like the Young Lords, right? Which was like a revolutionary Puerto Rican based group. Mm-hmm. And then the Black Panthers as well, which again is the most revolutionary, one of the most revolutionary groups we've had in the history of America, right? Mm-hmm. Like one of the most successful revolutionary organizations that we've had. And again, you have to like, we have to understand what the Black Panthers were. I mean, were they a perfect organization? Absolutely not. But like they predicated a lot of their ideology in terms of a revolutionary Black nationalism and how they would struggle against the state on the basis of an understanding of like a Black oppressed nation within this, right? And then after Stonewall, you have quotes from Huey Newton. And I'm going to reference that post you sent me from a homo communist. And it's like apparent in like a lot of Huey's quotes here, he was reflecting on some preconceived notions about what he had about like the homosexual community in particular, which is he's referencing in this quote. And then he says, there's nothing to say that a homosexual cannot also be revolutionary, right? And he says, then maybe I'm now injecting some of my prejudice by saying that even a homosexual can be revolutionary. Mm. Quite the contrary, maybe a homosexual could be the most revolutionary, right? So the point I want to make here is that like there's this moment in time where these struggles are starting to get connected on like a revolutionary, anti-imperialist, class conscious basis, you know, and those connections still exist for us. The other point that I want to make on this is that, you know, not everybody's perfect, right? And oftentimes we get better when we struggle together, you know, like, again, to go back to, I'm going to keep going back to like who I am. I'm a white dude raised in rural Pennsylvania. You can bet I had some, you know, bad views off. I wasn't born perfect. You know, I was raised up with a certain set of conditions. It's not to say that people in there were bad or whatever, but like I had some baggage that I had to unpack. But, you know, now I'm again organizing on the streets with like trans comrades, gay comrades, Black comrades, whatever. Like it's the broad spectrum of American society. And it's like we're all getting better together. And me in particular, I'm getting even, you know, much better than what my foundation was on this stuff. So I guess the point is that like these kind of moments and these connections can really help us all improve and connect these struggles as well. And it happens again in like that real life context. Not in these conversations, I hope, are important to facilitate that kind of progress, you know, even on like an individual level that extends out to how we organize, right? And then I'll just make one more point, because again, we're talking about Huey Newton here, right? And I think this is going to lead into your point about pinkwashing, right? And, you know, I think we could look at a place like Cuba, right? And I think a lot of people will dismiss Cuba and the history of the Cuban Revolution by condemning some of the, I mean, rightfully condemning at mm-hmm. some level, some pretty shitty views on the LGBTQ plus community by Castro and by Che Guevara, again, as like leaders of that movement. And again, I'm not going to deny that they had some pretty shitty positions on this early on. But I think the point is that like, they as individuals improved, and the country of Cuba improved on that as well as a result, to the point that they probably have one of the most progressive family codes that a state can put out in the world right now. You know, so the point is that it's like we need to just educate ourselves and continue to get better. And that often happens through like a radical revolutionary struggle. Sorry for the long-winded.
I just have something quick to sort of add to that. So Huey Newton is just this incredibly fascinating figure. But we make this point over and over again that these leaders, while they make these narratives really easy to tell, they're parts of larger movements. There were people within the Black Panthers that really appreciated what he said about queer allyship. And there are people within the Black Panthers that did not appreciate what he had to say about queer allyship. And it's really, that's the struggle. And to, I think, link it to a point that you made earlier, Destiny, this idea of telling the history as telling something appropriating the truth, quote unquote. There's a lot of different truth that comes out of a movement because we can't look at one individual and say that their views represent the entire plethora of ideas and realities that people are facing in their day-to-day life in 1972, 1973, 1970, any point in history. So while it might be some sort of idealizing of the Black Panther movement to talk about Huey Newton, his support of the queer movement, it's just important to note that those segments did exist and they are something to embrace in the same way that in Cuba they had bad positions at certain times, but there were always people within the state of Cuba that were struggling against those positions and their voices deserve to be told in the same way that in your media, you're trying to take these histories and bring them to light, that they're important. Even if they're a minority, that doesn't mean that they're always going to be a minority. They might be looked back upon as the history of what ended up being the evolution of the movement.
Yeah, exactly. And I was reading Lessons from the 60s by Audre Lorde the other day, and she says that revolution is not a one-time event. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but that essentially, like, we have to recognize the small change that's happening all around us, even if it's internalized or it could be external progress, but also that we have to recognize change in ourselves, too. And, you know, Nick, that you shared your background and, like, you know, even though I identify as part of the LGBTQ plus community, I mean, I definitely have internalized homophobia and things that impacted the way that I thought about myself and how I was able to show up with others, too. And so, you know, even if you're part of a marginalized community, doesn't mean that you're still not being oppressive in the way that the systems are set up for you to be, you know, because here in the imperial core, our social systems are deeply, deeply embedded with white supremacy. And if you've ever seen the 12 tenets of white supremacy, like urgency, perfectionism, you know, there are ways that that is embedded in our life. Like the reason why we feel guilty when we're not doing something productive, the reason why, you know, you finally have a moment to rest and you can feel the anxiety in your body. So, you know, that like these things are deeply inside of us. And so I think that the only thing that we can do is just continue to learn and acknowledge where that small change is. But we have to keep digging deeper because, you know, as we've discussed here, that history is told by those who control the narrative.
Yeah.
And so maybe now we can like go into Israel-Palestine thing. I shared before that like I really didn't know anything about Zionism. I didn't know really anything about Judaism either. You know, that I identify as an atheist. I grew up Southern Baptist, going to my grandparents' very racist church, and again in North Carolina, and you know, so it just wasn't anything that I thought of. And then October 7th happened, and I started following a lot of the press there in like on the ground in Gaza, and I was completely horrified by what I was seeing. And so, you know, I I was watching YouTube videos, reading articles, and just trying to learn like the history. And I learned about what happened in 1947 and then just like kept going from there. And I've been reading The Hundred Years War. And that's been very, very informative. I didn't realize not only the like overt violence, but also the systemic ways in which Palestinian people were like kept from even contributing to where they lived. This like disenfranchised Palestinian people even further. So, you know, how this history is being told also matters. And I think that for people who aren't quite as far left as we are, what I guess the common person knows about Israel and about Zionism is starkly different from what someone who identifies as an anti-imperialist or a leftist knows. But it's been really hard to distinguish what the truth is with that also, because like there are also so many propaganda accounts on social media. And I'm an educator. We have this conversation all the time about why media literacy is so crucial right now. Like with the world of AI and deep fakes, and like it is becoming even more relevant and important.
Yeah. And like, I don't mean to say like, I don't want to say like, oh, distinguish between real life and like, you know, the online space, because I think those things do interplay, you know what I mean? In terms of how these conversations, especially like, let's face it, like a lot of people on the left are like active online. I don't want to say categorically so, but I mean, with this conversation with Israel, right, and how we can kind of square it within the context of our conversation tonight, like you mentioned the term, it's like pinkwashing, right? And how people understand Israel through kind of the lens of like Western norms and values, I think, you know, as juxtaposed with Palestine. So just to bring it back to what I was talking about with like real life, like one of my comrades came up to me and was like, what are we doing about educating in like the queer community on this? So just to your point, it's just like, you know, I think there's this assumption that like, you know, that community is very progressive and they probably have, and this is, I'm speaking from my personal position here, that like that community is probably pretty progressive. They probably have a decent, at least understanding of what's going on now. But the comrade was like, no, like a lot of people just don't want to touch it because like they have this impression that like, you know, Palestinians are like these oppressive people. Like, obviously it's, you know, it's horrible, but it seems like it's a fight that, you know, is just happening between two people. They don't really understand the history and the context. And then like this pinkwashing element has kind of just like dissuaded them, I guess, at some level from investigating it even further. Now, again, I'm talking about a particular experience here. I don't want to talk about anything categorically so, but it was a microcosm of an experience that I think is, you know, why a conversation like this might be important, you know?
And you can tie both things that everyone said together, you know, the propaganda side of it and then the pinkwashing side of it, because As Nick said before this discussion, you know, I ingest a lot of really shitty media, and all you have to do is watch Bill Maher and just have him up on a pedestal saying, if you're in the queer community and you don't support Israel, there's something wrong with you because they are a liberal society. So, and it goes to all the propaganda, not just online, but just, you know, historically, traditionally, what we've learned in school, in a Western society, the propaganda, it just, the pro-Israeli propaganda is everywhere you look. It's not just online. It's our politicians, the schooling, everything. I think really it's difficult for, you know, a person that doesn't do the work to get past that, I think.
Well, and I think that can, like, it's a connecting point where people don't even realize that it is, that, like, in the same way that history has been whitewashed or, like, very heteronormative, that also history has been very pro-Israel.
Yeah, and we've done a few episodes on this. specifically with Joe from Joe Wrote and Evan from Left of the Projector on the Israeli version of propaganda that's known broadly as Hasbara. And I think a really good entry into this, if people can look this up, but Ta-Nehisi Coates did numerous interviews across independent media, I think most notably Democracy Now!, where he talked about visiting Israel in November or late October and talking about how he was raised to believe that Israel was, you know, quote unquote, the only democracy in the Middle East. And it has all the baggage, the positive concepts that go along with that. But after visiting Israel, seeing the West Bank, he understood it as an apartheid in the Middle East. And that really changes the understanding of all of the baggage that's clung to this idea of a liberal democracy where people of a specific ethnicity are actually not permitted to participate. Where you can say technically that's a democracy, but it's a Jim Crow democracy as he understood it. It's not something that should actually be taken uncritically. But if you just think about it as this event or this conflict that's happening out of sight, and you just take the propaganda, the Hasbara, the ideas that you have of this history for granted, it really, you can't see past that obfuscation, because the way that narrative has been built in popular media intentionally creates this idea of the only democracy in the Middle East. And are you really going to be opposed to democracy?
Yeah. What does that word actually mean, though, you know, at some level?
Mm-hmm.
Another lens that I think may be helpful for folks to assess this situation through, especially for the purposes of this show, and this is, I'm not going to claim to be an expert. I was recently turned on to this term by one of my comrades, but homo nationalism, and it comes from this book called Terrorist Assemblages, Homo Nationalism in Queer Times by Jasbir K. Poir. And just for right now, I think a good way to understand this term is, quote, how acceptance and tolerance for gay and lesbian subjects have become a barometer by which the right to and capacity for national sovereignty is evaluated, right? So again, in this conversation, to really put it into layman's terms, like you can look at like the IOF, right? And they can say, oh, like gays can serve in the military, right? And then on the other hand, we understand through the lens of, you know, media propaganda and just kind of inherent Orientalism and racism that like Palestinians must be an oppressive society run by Sharia law. I mean, again, I'm just trying to think about like what like the basic understanding of, you know, an American might be just approaching this, right? So you have this juxtaposition, right? But like within that definition there, it's like you have to ask yourself, who is making that evaluation for fitness for self-governance and national sovereignty, right? And it's the West, right? And then this other place that appears to align with our values must be our friend, and they must be doing it better than this other group that I have kind of like this marred understanding of, that I don't even realize I have this marred understanding of because of all the propaganda and the layers of, like, again, atrocity propaganda and history, quote unquote history, that are already kind of existent in our minds, you know?
Yeah, I think that like it's just Islamophobia like cloaked as something else. And you know, maybe I have too much faith in people, but I think that homophobia is typically learned and conditioned. And I think that people can unlearn and deprogram themselves a little bit. So I don't think that not being homophobic is a threshold for like deserving to live, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And now we're at the, I mean, through that lens, we're at like the most heinous stage of this, right? Where it's like, this society is oppressive anyway, right? And now like Israel's got carte blanche to commit genocide, essentially, from, again, from like the US state perspective, you know? And these ideas of pinkwashing, like, I think either lead a lot of people in our society to just like, and again, I'm not saying this is like the end all be all of what it is. It's just a part of the overall Hasbara, right? In terms of what actually leads into mass support in the US for Israel. But again, this cog in this like propaganda machine is really led us to a point where like some segments of the population are just like, yeah, kill them all. You know, I mean, because that's what's going on right now. Like it's we're in a late stage of a genocide perpetrated by Israel.
And I think to Destiny's point, though, about faith and humanity, when you say that most, I don't know that you actually said the phrase most people are supporting this, but it's definitely most politicians are supporting it. But I would argue that most people are really not supporting the genocide in Palestine, that people are resistant to the idea of extermination of human beings in order to even support the concept of pinkwashing. And I think that speaks to the larger issue that when people are given the information and seeing how these things can be abused, when they are looking on YouTube or looking at direct video coming from Gaza, they're not going to fall for these sort of little tricks about how gay women can serve in the IOF. They're more concerned about children being murdered in their homes than they are the rights of a gay man to murder a child in their home.
Yeah. No, and I want to be clear. Like, I hope I corrected myself, but segments.
Yes.
Like,
yes. And
if you just look at like the polls, I think it's like 70-80% of like self-identified Democrats support a ceasefire, and even a majority of Republicans. So we're at like a super majority of the population as a whole that supports at least a ceasefire. So yeah, that's an important clarification.
Yeah, even though we just vetoed for the third time.
And that's why we don't live in a democracy, folks.
I was going to say the UN, that's the only democracy in the world, because the US gets to determine what's right or wrong.
Right. Well, and so really we are like up against state sanctioned violence that is then not questioned by folks. I mean, you know, Levi, I'm with you. I think that most people don't condone that, but it's very strange because I know that, like, Nick, you're an organizer, and Levi, you have an academic background, and at least at school, and I mean, again, I'm in North Carolina, but like no one is talking about it. They're like, it's crickets. Like, there are literally two people at work who I have talked to about it. And I mean, some people are on the other side and say that it's justified, and then other people just aren't talking about it at all. But it kind of feels like we're in this weird like limbo stage where like people are aware, but like nothing's happening. Like the ceasefire's not happening. I mean, there are protests happening and like great action on the ground, but you know, at least where I'm standing here in North Carolina as a very privileged Westerner, that it doesn't feel like enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, my response there is like that to be able to kind of do more, like we have to be more organized, you know, and I know that's like the trite point, like oh, the communist is on the podcast telling you to get organized. But I mean it very really, like, whereas like, you know, if people want to organize mass strikes, that means you have to do the hard work of actually building a relationship with like labor unions and things like that, and getting those workers to trust you, and actually setting up infrastructure to support a strike fund potentially, you know.
Can you have unions in Pennsylvania?
Well, that's another thing. We have to fight to rebuild the union struggle and the radical union struggle. But yeah, I mean, the South is a whole different ballgame, right? Like,
yeah, because we work. Like, oh, that's right. Cute. We can't have those.
Yeah.
We're right to work.
It's going to take like a lot of work, and we have to build organizational power. And I think part of that is like trying to get back to some of these like radical roots of like, because again, like, the oppressed groupings within this nation have the most revolutionary potential. Some of them may not know it, but like the most oppressed, I mean, throughout history, that has shown that like these are the groups that have revolutionary potential. And I think that there's like a conscious effort to pull these groups with this revolutionary potential into kind of like acceptable society, you know what I mean? Or like just within, like to operate within like this, again, the structures that the powers that be have deemed to be acceptable, right? So like we have to build on a multiple fronts. We need to reconnect the radical Black movement, the radical Black nationalist movement, like the LGBTQ plus radical struggle, right? And pull more people into that and then pull that into labor. And then like to be able to do the actions that we actually need to do to stop a genocide, you know? And it kind of sounds like powerless at the moment, because like I know we all want to do more, but as individuals we really can't do all that much.
Yeah, and I don't want to distract from the larger point that Nick is making, but you mentioned the university and the sort of crickets that you're getting there. And you're at a university, correct? This isn't like a secondary education.
Oh no, I'm in a public high school.
Oh okay, well my point still kind of stands, but education is not really the place where a lot of radical organization takes place in the United States historically. I mean, if the question is asked, what is the oldest corporation in the Western Hemisphere? The answer is Harvard. And they didn't have a student union organized until 2019. They are a corporation organized to make the most amount of profit off of their students and their product as possible. If that meant investing in slavery, which they did, that's what they would do. Their interest is not in necessarily the quote-unquote truth of the narrative that we were talking about earlier. It's in appeasing joint stockholders. That's why you might hear crickets at an academic institution, is because they're not beholden to the concept of truth, no matter what their website says. They're beholden to the people that allow them to continue to make a profit.
Regardless of the land acknowledgement that they do in the beginning of their meetings, they're not necessarily as invested in progress. Yeah.
If anything, they were more invested in westward expansion than they were in land acknowledgements.
You don't say.
I would also assume that schools are like, with the, you know, effectively this war on education that the right is waging right now, I would assume schools are, teachers are just petrified to have any kind of opinions about things right now as well.
Well, it's definitely complicated. I think that there are a number of things that go into it. I mean, definitely, like, we just recently had a Don't Say Gay bill come to North Carolina. There's the infamous one in Florida, and there have been tons of ones across the nation. And I think actually in 2023, there were over 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills filed in the United States. And recently, there was a non-binary teenager who was part of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma City that was murdered at school. So I think that there are a lot of things that are going on that, like you said, Steve, that teachers definitely are afraid to speak out and to make inclusive curriculum, inclusive in every sense of the word, and going back to what we were talking about with intersectionality. There was one point that you, Levi, you said that historically, like, that teachers' education hasn't really been like a place for progress. And it's sad, because yes and no. Like, I was actually, there's this book, it's called Out in the Union, and the Federal Teachers Association was actually the very first union to acknowledge or to like bring in LGBTQ plus inclusiveness within the workplace. And it was the first time that that happened within a union. But then also, education is also dominated by white women, and there's a lot of white feminism that exists and that unfortunately excludes a lot of marginalized communities that we could be in unison with, but we're not.
Yeah, and just to clarify that, or complicate it even further, when I said education, I'm more talking about like the white male superstructure of academic, Harvard, Ivy League, high-level institutions, because of course there's HBCUs and predominantly Black school districts where you're going to hear that kind of language or that kind of inclusivity, with all the caveats that might come with time and place. But when we're talking about larger structures, the superstructure of the way the nation reproduces history, memory, ideology, what goes on, WQED or National Public Broadcasting or CNN, it's not coming from the radical leftist teachers union. It's most likely coming from the stodgy white million-year-old that's, you know, the head of the history department at Yale,
who Prager has,
yeah, Prager. Yeah. There's only a slight difference between the two in some ways, but yeah, exactly.
Well, and like also each community has its own version of homo nationalism. You know, their capital T truth excludes some versions too. Like, for instance, one time I did an episode on George Washington Carver because I was talking about LGBTQ plus people in STEM, and it's rumored that he was bisexual and that he sometimes enjoyed the company of men at Tuskegee University, and he had a partner there. But you know, on some websites, it's like, oh, no, you know, he just was a great mentor and they were best friends. And then, you know, on other websites, it's like, oh, nah, they were lovers. And like, that's just how it was. But, you know, that
some Alexander the Great stuff, huh?
Well, that like there's homophobia within different communities also, and like what is tolerable is different for each community. And like you said, it's not coming from, you know, the very radical leftist teachers union, because like even Bayard Rustin, you know, I told you that like, he was a communist, but like I had to dig for that one. You know, it's not just common knowledge that he was a communist, because that's very hidden history.
Yeah. You know, one thing to go back to the point about, I guess, this grassroots efforts to change curriculum, grassroots in quotes, because they're actually funded by like these big institutions. I mean, we mentioned PragerU, right? But there's a lot of these efforts to, you know, basically make school boards like transphobic, right? And like eliminate like critical race theory type kind of learning in high schools and in primary schools. I mean, these people are really nuts, you know? And I'm thinking about this as we're talking about essentially, I just like want to be careful, because like, it's not like we're coming and saying that like, it's not good that like gay people can get married. That is a good thing.
Yeah,
that's something that like we still have to fight for. And that's something that, again, like radicals have been, to the earlier point, I think that Steve or Levi made, or I think we've all probably made at some level at this point, that like the radicals have been the leading edge in the fight for those kind of things, right? And then it later gets told differently, that oh, like these liberal heroes actually got this, like, or some great liberal hero, some great man on high came down and bestowed this upon the people, ignoring like the mass movements, right? So like we still have to be fighting for that stuff. And I think it's, we have to really look at it right now as like a multi-front fight, where it's like we need to change this system in its totality, right? And like I think we need to, one, move people away from like this idea that like these progressive, like individualistic wins are enough and get people back to their radical roots. But then we also have to fight these retrograde forces on the other side, right? Because like, I think, and it, this comes up a lot, especially like these online spaces that are talking about like anti-imperialism. It's like, they want to forsake some of these like social struggles, like for the sake of like, you know, the decline of empire. And it's like, no, like that's that, we can't do that. You know what I mean? Because like, things like fascism and the decline of empires are like very much interrelated, right? So as the empire falls on the world stage and conditions deteriorate here, we're going to see a rise in fascistic elements at, in our domestic front as well. And like, they're already laying the groundwork for scapegoating the most oppressed people by like these efforts to demonize trans kids as an example, you know? So like we have to be serious about fighting on all these different fronts, and we can't capitulate to reactionaryism on anything, you know? Like we know better now. We know better. We're living in 2024, and we need to build comradeship with the most oppressed people, and again, educate people that this is a domestic fight. It's a global fight, and we all need to get together for it.
No war, but class war.
Yeah.
I think that there kind of has been like a social consciousness that things have been changing, especially since like post lockdown period of the pandemic, that at least for me, if you knew me before the pandemic, you didn't know me, because like You know, yeah. I found out that I have ADHD at 27 years old, and now I'm 31 and I feel like a totally different person. And I didn't know before the pandemic, at least like before the lockdown. And so the lockdown happened and disabled folks were left behind, that now like we see a resurgence in anti-LGBTQ plus rhetoric, and people are getting hurt and being left behind. And that I think in 2020, hopefully, a lot of people really became more aware of systemic racism. And but even then, like, what has changed as far as like police brutality, that folks are being left behind. So like you said, like, we live in 2024. It is time for us to like have that comradeship and just really work together regardless of what our backgrounds look like, because we all do have the same radical roots.
Yeah. And the right have a playbook, right, for all this stuff they do. They have, for what they're doing to the LGBTQ plus community now, is exactly what they did during the civil rights movement to the African American and the Black communities. But the left has one as well. We have, you know, we can look back at the radical movements in the past and, you know, improve where we need to. As Nick has said, you know, nothing is perfect. So obviously we have to make improvements, but we are going to have to do that to push back against these people. Because, you know, again, maybe it's just because I listen to this garbage a lot. I don't know. I like Nick said, I don't know why, but I guess I do it for podcast research, but they're very loud.
We make him do it.
And they're very loud. And, you know, infiltrating school boards and doing all this stuff that they, you know, these plans that they have and they're enacting on, you know, you just have to be ready and, you know, organize together to fight back against that.
Yeah. Maybe as a sort of concluding remark, to pull on what Nick was saying, this reactionary aspect is largely astroturfed. It's heavily funded. There's a lot of money going into those right-wing podcasts. I swear to you, listeners, we are not getting any money from Koch Industries. But I love going back to that quotation. I think we've done it at least three times before, by Zhou Enlai, talking about the French Revolution, where he's asked by Henry Kissinger in the 1970s about his opinion on the conclusion of that. And he, you know, 200 years after the fact, said that it's too early to tell. And that's where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. Like you said, 2020 was a watershed moment. There's been watershed moments since 1969 with the Stonewall Rebellion. These things are constantly developing and percolating over time. While 1969, let's do some quick math here. That would be 65 years ago. 75 years ago. I'm not a math
55 guy. You're going the wrong way.
Oh man. See, I'm a history doctorate. I'm not a math guy. But that's a relatively short amount of time in terms of human history.
Mm-hmm.
These things are constantly changing, and as we said earlier, the population is against the genocide. They want at the very least a ceasefire. It's the people that are in charge that are really holding this up, so things can change. And that's the positive thing that I always try to hold on to when we have these conversations, is that the people are on our side, even if they don't know it yet. They support the basic concepts, even if they don't have the $4, the $5 words that we might have to say it. And I would trade in all the $5 words if it would mean that we just get to that next level and we all have a more equitable society.
Well, maybe we can close off here for now. Thanks so much for joining me, and thank you for your beautifully said concluding sentence, Levi. Thanks for having me on your show and being on my show and just being my comrades. I appreciate you.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. I was glad that we were able to connect. I think this was a good collab, and I think it's the basis for us to do some more cool stuff together. So thank you.
Second that.
Yeah, that'd be good. Thanks very much.